My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today, a real-life chamber musician, Norman Fisher. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Norman is a cellist. He's a professor at Rice University's Shepherd School of Music. He is a member of the Fisher Duo with pianist Jeannie Kierman, which they've been doing for over 43 years. He's a member of the Grammy and Emmy-nominated Concord String Quartet, and in his quote-unquote off time, his summer gig, is coordinating the chamber music at the Tanglewood Music Center. So, given all of that cred, what are you going to be teaching me about today?
Oh, I thought it would be really fun to talk about Beethoven, and specifically the Beethoven works for cello and piano, since we have the CD that just came out, and I've been bathing in this repertoire for, you know, so long, that it would be fun to talk to you about that.
Cool. I love it. I love talking about, like, the, you know, the big sort of founding fathers of classical music, because, I mean, their work is just so genius, and, like, learning about how their genius works is so
awesome. I love the way you say founding fathers, because in a way, with some of the mediums that we look at in terms of groups, you know, like the symphony orchestra, symphonies, or piano trios, you know, violin, cello, and piano is a sort of a medium, or the string quartet, that Joseph Haydn, who was Beethoven's teacher, was sort of the person who both created that and then took it in a kind of evolutionary state to some apex. And so Beethoven copied what Haydn did in terms of writing piano sonatas, just for piano alone, piano trios, the symphony orchestra. But then he invented the cello and piano sonata.
Beethoven invented this
because
form.
Although there were pieces for cello and accompaniment, you know, before, there wasn't anything where the relationship between the piano and the cello was really co-equal, and where they had equally important parts. And so it was, they would switch off about who's in the four and who's who's accompanying. It's a little bit like basketball players, you know, something like passing the ball around.
People
take shots at different times. You know, it becomes a very exciting thing to watch and to listen to, because there's a lot of shared energy and passion going back and forth.
That's one thing that I've learned about chamber music recently, is that it's like this very sort of democratic form of music where, like, each instrument sort of has equal importance.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and even if you think that, let's say, the first violin in a string quartet is sort of the more show-off voice, and they have more notes and everything else, all the things that are going on inside of that may not be quite so glitzy on the front the first time you hear it, but the energy is really important about what happens inside of that. And so if you're taking something like a cello and piano sonata, we have the piano is playing lots of different voices, right? And the cello can only really play one voice at a time. But it's really complicated and interesting to hear what's going on in terms of the interplay of all the stuff, the left hand and different voices in the left hand. That's the lower voices that the piano plays, or the tinkly things in the right hand, the little high things that you hear in the piano. And sometimes the cello sits in the middle. It's really fun.
When I was listening to the sonata in E-flat major,
yeah,
I noticed that it was kind of like, listening to musical ping pong.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they go back and forth and they sort of swap off, but then they have this sort of, it's like they're having a conversation and then they have a resolution where they're both kind of talking at the same time.
Well, I love that you're talking about that E-flat sonata, because that, I'll bet if there are people that are really serious musicians and they say, wait a minute, there is no sonata in E-flat major by Beethoven, because most people don't know that this piece exists.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's because it's an arrangement of another chamber music work, a work for violin, viola, and cello. And Beethoven took that piece and made a version for cello and piano. So many times, because the violin part is the top part, that might be in the right hand of the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And the cello sometimes plays the viola part, weirdly. And then the bass part would be the left hand. And so it has this thing, but it's not always the case. So sometimes the cello will play the bass line. Sometimes it will play the violin part. And it sort of moves around. And so it's very interesting. But that actually was written originally as a three-voice chamber music piece for three string instruments.
That's so interesting that he took a three instrument piece and arranged it for two, and then worked it out with like counting the pianist as two, and then the cello as one. That's really, really neat.
Yeah. So actually, the reason why he started to do that, he did a tour with Count Lichnowsky, who was in Vienna with Beethoven, and Lichnowsky had taken Mozart on the same trip.
Mm-hmm.
To go to different musical capitals in Europe, sort of presenting his calling card and getting people to meet Mozart. And he wanted to do the same thing with Beethoven. And so they went to Prague, and they went to Dresden, and they went to Leipzig. And then Lichnowsky with Mozart had to go back to Vienna because he had his day job.
Mm-hmm.
And he left Mozart. Mozart was supposed to get to Berlin and work out something with Frederick William II, the cello-playing king. Yes. So... But Lichnowsky went with Beethoven, and Beethoven got into the court, and he was hanging out there for the whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took with him the manuscript of the Opus 3 string trio that he'd finished and said, once I'm here, maybe I can figure out if I can make an arrangement of this, and that would make the cello-playing king happy.
Mm.
Maybe get me on the dole so I could get on retainer, and that would give me a little revenue stream that would keep me safe, you know, financially. And so once he started to do that arrangement, I think he realized I should just write some original composition while I'm here. And then he actually said, because I'm going to make an impression.
Yeah. So basically he was writing these sorts of works to impress.
Oh, yeah.
So
when you hear these Opus 5 sonatas, it's all about that. I mean, it is really powerful, bold, imaginative. I mean, he's putting his best stuff into these sonatas because he's really trying to make an impression. He wants to make an impression as a pianist, so the piano parts are really hard.
Yeah.
He wants to make an impression about his composition because he wants to show how serious and how creative and inventive he is. And he wants to show that he can write really well for the cello.
Right.
So he's trying to do all three of those things at the same time. One thing that you'll hear in these Opus 5 sonatas, there are two of them. Both of them start with very long, slow introductions. Take, for example, the opening of the Opus 5 number 1, the F major sonata.
Uh-huh.
It's very interesting because he starts with four notes.
Mm-hmm.
It goes ta-da, do-di, silence. Dee-dee-da-da-da-da. Just the cello and the piano together playing the same notes at the same time. And then they do it again. And then sort of say, but the silence is very dramatic in both of these cases. In the G minor, which opens, there's a big chord. and then you have this, so almost like an explosion, and then you watch something falling down from the ceiling after the big crash. Bum, 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 you know? But the silences that happen at the end of this long movement of the G minor are really, really long. Mm-hmm. And because of the harmony, it should make you feel uneasy.
Uh-huh.
Because there's no resolution, and the silence is so long, you sort of say, is that, that can't be the end. And yet, what do we do?
Yeah.
Because part of what music does, of course, is set up expectations about what's going to happen. You know, so harmony, sequences and harmony are follow certain sort of procedures. Mm-hmm. And so you'll hear a certain kind of a chord, and you expect a resolution of that, you know, the tension and the harmony, and then it resolves.
Right.
You know, and so the same thing happens with what happens. There's a silence of a certain length, and then you come in mm-hmm. in time with the rhythm, mm-hmm. right? In this particular case, he sets it up, and there's the silence, but then there's nothing.
It creates a sort of like narrative tension.
Oh my gosh, you absolutely.
Know, yeah, it's kind of like, I was just thinking there's another kind of music called dubstep where they, like the music is made up of as much of silences as it is of notes. And it keeps you, the effect that it has is that it kind of keeps you in this state of heightened, oh my God, what's going to happen? What's happening next?
Yeah. Well, I remember also I heard about someone taking a conversation and editing out all the breathing. And so there was, and people would listen to it and they got very anxious and very agitated. They didn't know why, because everything else is sort of the same, but there's no breathing. And they're so used to hearing it, they don't know what it is that they're missing, but they, you know, so there are all these kinds of manipulations about silence, about other things that they're, this is a normal condition, mm-hmm. and then you have an abnormal condition, like extra long silences mm-hmm. or chords that don't resolve, you know.
And so is this sort of part of Beethoven's genius, is that he was very aware, like a good writer, very aware of how to use those silences and use the notes?
Yeah, well, also, yes. But I think he was actually, because he wanted to make such an impression,
uh-huh.
you know, he was willing to go out on a limb.
Yeah.
And make sure that people wouldn't forget him.
Uh-huh.
When Jeannie and I visited the Marble Palace in Potsdam, where Beethoven did the premieres of these pieces. And it's very interesting. I did the audio tour, and you're going around. And then we came, and there was absolutely nothing about Beethoven anywhere in this place, just all about Frank William. And there was his music room where he practiced the cello, and there were all these things. But nobody said anything about Beethoven until we got on the audio tour. We got to the main hall, which is on the second floor, and it runs the whole length of the palace. And then you look outside to this beautiful lake. It's just gorgeous. The inlaid wood and all this stuff is amazing. And on the audio tape, they were saying about Beethoven coming and premiering some pieces, and that he was absolutely pounding this Gottfried Silbermann piano that Frederick William owned. And Frederick William was very annoyed because he thought he was going to break the piano.
And Beethoven's like, whatever, I'm Beethoven.
Yeah, right,
I can do
exactly.
Whatever I want.
He wanted to make sure he was going to make it. So these silences, these more radical ideas, and he was pushing, uh-huh. pushing the medium, pushing the ideas,
uh-huh.
you know. So there's so much that happens in this early period with how Beethoven is just coming to grips with the cello. It's so, so fantastic.
Why cello and piano mm-hmm. particularly? I mean, I know because of the king.
Yep.
Like this was a sort of financially good decision for Beethoven to make to write in the cello.
Right.
But why pair it with the piano, and like why do those instruments seem to work so well together?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, because, you know, on paper they wouldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, because you have the cello is a sustaining, singing instrument, right? Mm-hmm. And the piano is a percussion instrument, basically, right? Because you play a note on the piano, and it just decays, right? There's no way to sustain it. On the organ, if you played that note, it would sustain at the same volume until you lifted the finger. Mm-hmm. Say. Mm-hmm. On the cello, the bow goes over the string, and it makes a long note, and you connect the notes. We say legato is an Italian term meaning to connect, you know. And so it goes legato, and it's a big singing line, just like you would, like a person would sing. Then sometimes cello can pluck the string, like a guitar or something mm-hmm. like that, and then it's just like a piano, mm-hmm. because then it goes bong, and that is just a short note. So you're sort of saying, but these instruments wouldn't fit like a string quartet. They're all playing violin instruments, and so that they could do all these things. So how do you get these things to work together? And so it takes a great deal of imagination to understand how you make the sounds meld in a way. Mm-hmm. So the way that the piano will play chords by going doodly 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 sustains a harmony, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So if they went dung, it would drop.
Right.
You see? But if it goes doodly 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 doodly, and this is what's happening in a lot in the Allegro part of the Opus 5, mm-hmm. number 2, the G minor is doodly 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 doodly. In Opus 5, number 1, he goes same chord, and then new chord. You can hear those things happening. So there are lots of ways in which Beethoven is creating the illusions of other things happening.
Right.
But this idea...
Oh, that's a really interesting way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, but this idea about a sustaining and non-sustaining instrument and doing that, after a while... It's so second nature the way Beethoven is writing. By the time he gets to the late sonatas, mm-hmm. you don't even notice that because of the way in which he's much more sophisticated about how he's handling sustaining sounds in the piano and sustaining and non-sustaining in the cello, and they sort of weave one into the other, and it just seems like the most natural thing in the world.
Yeah.
Actually, I'd like to tell you about Elliot Carter for a minute.
Okay,
so he's an American composer, and he just died a few years ago mm-hmm. at the age of 103.
Holy moly.
Yeah, and so he's one of our most important American composers. One of his first significant pieces was a cello sonata, and he said, I'm trying to figure out how to make this non-sustaining and sustaining instrument work together. Mm-hmm. And he came at it from a completely new way, sort of, but drinking all the stuff in that Beethoven had done and doing something, again, sort of new.
Moving it
that
forward.
Dealt with concepts of time and ways in which you perceive meter and rhythm. And so he took it another step beyond in that way. But thank God for Beethoven, because as a result of that, and the importance of this body of work, Mendelssohn, Schumann, and Brahms, every composer had to have their time with a cello sonata as well. And so we're really, repertoire is rich with important and wonderful works by almost all the major composers.
So he basically set a bar.
Yeah.
He invented a form, which, you know, because he was Beethoven, every composer who came along after him felt like they needed to conquer that form.
Right.
Huh.
But like Haydn, the coolest part about this, he invents the form, and then he takes it to such a high point in his own lifetime. Really, between 1796 and 1815, that's not a very long period of time.
Yeah.
And he, in terms of what happened in that medium that he was writing for cello and piano, and he took between those few years and made it just, you know, 19 years basically. And he took this form to an entirely different level, you know. But that's what's so amazing. But the cello, you know, the voice of the cello. Well, I have to say a couple things about this. Of course, this is, you know, I'm scratching my back. But the cello is such a beautiful instrument. I mean, the singing tone, and it is unique among other instruments in that it can sing in the range of any human voice. So the highest notes on the cello would be the highest notes that a soprano could sing, and the lowest notes on the cello, the lowest notes that that a bass would sing. And so you can, it goes through the entire vocal range. And composers that have written for the cello, that they love that about it, you know, because they can really go, I want this to be mezzo-soprano. I want this to be coloratura soprano. I want this to be a tenor aria. I want this to be a baritone, you know.
Yeah.
And so it does all those things. But then the other thing that I have to say is that cellists are really friendly, gregarious people. And so it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing. You don't know if they were like that and they were drawn to the cello because, or that the music was written for the cello becomes generous and wonderful, you know. But like, for example, Frédéric Chopin, you know, the great Polish composer, only wrote piano music except for a piano trio, a cello sonata, and a polonaise for cello and piano. And the reason why he chose the cello is that he had a really good friend, Auguste Franchomme, who was his buddy. And then they sat down and said, I'd like to write something for you, and we could do this together. And so they sort of, they would improvise together and hang out and do this kind of stuff. And then the cello sonata, which wound up being his last major piece, was sort of written as a result of friendship.
That's,
you know?
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's the fact that, like, Beethoven basically, I mean, well, he did invent a form of music based on his financial needs and his circumstances. And then, like, Chopin just knew a dude who he liked and was like, hey, I want to write something for you. And
Oh, Mendelssohn wrote for his brother, Paul, you know? And so there are lots of ways in which you sort of see particular people that Brahms wrote for Hausmann, you know, one of his buddies who was involved with his work. And Beethoven, of course, in the course of his life as a composer, knew lots of cellists and wrote for particular cellists. So although he was hoping for to get
the
dollar bills, right? on that first thing, unfortunately, Frederick William II, the cello playing king, died. So he didn't get the chance to,
That's tragic.
Didn't get a chance to get on the dole. But then when he had other pieces come up, he was writing for Nicholas Kraft, who was one of the cellists, and then Josef Linke, who was another cellist, and Bernard Romberg, who was one of his buddies from his hometown, Bonn, came to Vienna also. And so he was involved in a lot of these performances too.
Okay.
So sort of there were always cellists that were involved.
He ran
in all
with
this.
The cellist crowd.
Yeah.
Says the cellist proudly.
Oh yeah.
I was wondering, because, you know, everybody knows that Beethoven was deaf and that he sort of became deaf, and this had like a big impact on his music. I'm curious, was he going deaf when he was writing these works? Was he, and if so, like how did that impact the composition? If not, how were these works different from works that he wrote when he was going deaf?
Oh, that's a really good question, because this is one of the great mysteries about Beethoven, you know, which is that certainly the first pieces where he was playing them, you know, for the king, a lot of these, the first pieces, of course, he was hearing fine then.
Yeah.
And then later on, he started realizing that he was losing his hearing. And so, for example, by the time you get to the A major sonata, the famous Opus 69, which is 1808, he wasn't performing that. He didn't perform the premiere. And then also with the two late sonatas, he also didn't perform those. But there's something that's so amazing about what he does in the late period is, and this is where we feel that perhaps he was liberated from his hearing. So there was this sense about saying he was writing from his imagination onto the page without the actual physical ability to hear.
Without the interference of...
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so it was such a powerful meditative environment that it allowed this whole other level of imagination and creativity to happen because he's not distracted with hearing it. Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
To sound like that, but I mean, it's just the idea of that.
It kind of makes sense, though. I mean, like, when you're robbed of one of your five senses, like, it sort of comes out elsewhere. Like, you gain superpowers in some other area. And I guess this sort of unlocking of his imagination was his.
Yeah.
Was there anything about the cello that, and this maybe this is a total stretch, but you were talking about how the cello is like the human voice and how it can, you know, do the whole range of what the human voice can do. Was there anything, like he stuck with this even after, you know, the king dies and he's not going to be on the dole.
Right.
Did he maybe have an affinity for the cello because of how it sounded to his ears that were going bad, that it mimicked the human voice?
I think so.
Maybe it was easier for him to compose because he knew that so well?
Yeah, I think so. I think that he really discovered something when he pushed himself to write like that for the cello because it started pushing it forward, and he got lots of affirmation, I think, from the cellist that played this piece. And in the set, for example, this recording set that we have, he wrote in 1800, there was a French horn virtuoso that came to Vienna and knocked everybody's socks off. And his name was, he was an Italian, Giovanni Punto. And so he came into town and he played this. Beethoven says, I've got to write you a sonata. So he writes him this French horn sonata. And then it sounds a little bit like the Mozart horn concertos, but it's Beethoven. And so he writes this piece. And then he says, I don't know if any other horn player would be able to play this. It's so demanding. So he made his own arrangement for cello, which is a similar voice type in a way, in terms of range, than as a French horn. But then he starts adding a few things that aren't in the French horn version because the cello could do it and the French horn has to stop and breathe and take a rest. You know, cello doesn't have to do that.
Right.
So he writes other things in that horn sonata. But so that's 1800. And then by the time he gets to 1808, he's writing the A major sonata. And then he's between that, he writes the triple concerto for cello, which is of the three instruments. Triple concerto, which is a concerto with orchestra for three instruments.
Okay.
So there will be a violin, cello, and piano are soloists. But the cello is the star of the three. The cello plays the first melody in each of the movements and has the hardest part of all three. And it's clearly written with this phenomenal cellist that he had in mind. And he wanted to show him that he could really do that. So the cello has been part of his writing all the way through. And then, of course, all the string quartets and piano trios that involve the cello are being... So he has a really close affinity for writing for the cello through his whole career.
It sounds like he just kind of kept coming back to it over and over again. Well, Norman Fisher, I really appreciate you coming in here and being on the show.
Yeah, it's so much fun to talk to you about all this great stuff.
This is so cool.
Oh, yeah.
I learned so much today about... I mean... I guess I wasn't even aware that Beethoven wrote for such a small grouping of instruments. So this was really neat to see this side of him as a composer.
Cool. He was great.
No. And you guys should go out and get the Fisher Duo's new CD, which is called... Wait, I have it written here. It's called Beethoven Cello and Piano Complete, and it just came out in 2013.
Yeah, on Centaur label, and it's four CDs, so it is the most comprehensive collection of this repertoire that exists, actually. Because we recorded something. Yeah, we recorded something that's never been recorded before.
Yeah.
Which is a composing score, a draft that exists that we have, but nobody's ever recorded it. So people that are really interested in this famous A major sonata can hear what Beethoven had in mind before he did the final touches on it. It's really interesting.
Nice. I was listening to it in my car today, and it's just a really cool,
yeah,
cool way to hear this music, to hear Beethoven. I don't know. I really dug it.
Good.
So, everyone, you can find more Classical Classroom at houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. Or you can subscribe to us on iTunes or listen to us on our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/classicalclassroom. There's a full listing of all of our shows there. P.S. If you listen to us on iTunes, rate us and review us. It's just a nice thing to do. And if you listen on SoundCloud, follow us. We will not lead you astray. Thanks to our audio producer, Todd Tiddlywinks Holslander, to our program director, St. John Flynn, for his steadfastness. To Norman Fisher for being here today, to me for saying things, and to you for listening. Thanks, and we'll catch you next time.